Welcome. You're listening to Amped Up, the AMPO podcast. I'm Ellen Zaviska, Transportation Planning Manager with AMPO, which is the Association of Metropolitan Planning Organizations.
For this episode, I'm speaking with three guests about new greenhouse gas regulations in Minnesota and how they affect transportation planning. I'm talking today with Jonathan Ehrlich, Senior Manager of Transportation Research with the Metropolitan Council, which is the MPO for the Twin Cities region of Minneapolis-St. Paul. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good afternoon.
Also with me is Stephanie Halford. Stephanie is the Executive Director of the MPO in Grand Forks, North Dakota, which is a bi-state MPO in both Minnesota and North Dakota. And Stephanie's been very involved with the implementation of this regulation, representing the smaller MPOs in the state. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thanks. Excited to be here. Thank you.
And last but certainly not least, Chris Behrens, who is the GHG Impact Assessment Director with the Minnesota DOT. Welcome, Chris.
Looking forward to the discussion. Thanks.
So let's get into it. As I said in the intro, we're talking about some legislation regarding greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. Chris, could you start us off by just telling us about the basics of that legislation and how it affects emissions and specifically transportation?
Yeah. So what the Minnesota legislature did in 2023 was they looked at each sector in Minnesota and they asked what could they be doing to help reduce emissions across each of the sectors. And the transportation sector is the most significant contributor to emissions in Minnesota and the same across the country. And so they asked, what could we be doing to help bring emissions down more effectively in the transportation sector? And there's really, when you get down to it, two key areas for emissions reduction. There is people's individual choices to move and shift to lower emission vehicles, zero emission vehicles like electric cars. And then there are the type of transportation system that folks have to use in a given place, a given state, a given country, and the choices that allow every person to make to reduce their carbon footprint. And that can be done through taking transit, biking, things of that nature that we know bring emissions down. And so what the legislature did was they said, we want to make sure that we're evaluating the decisions that are being made more systematically and to assess the impacts from those decisions and whether or not they're aligned with the goals to bring emissions down. So what they landed on, what we have been tasked to develop, is a process for evaluating first capacity expansion projects, which our own analysis shows increases emissions when we expand the transportation system. And we've been tasked to identify the amount of emissions that comes from those capacity expansion decisions and then mitigate for them. And so that's the what brings us, I guess, here today.
Great. Thank you so much for that, for the explanation, Chris. So as you said, the legislation speaks to projects that are adding capacity to the transportation network and the need to mitigate emissions resulting from those. How are you determining what is or is not a capacity adding project? Can you start with that, Chris?
Yeah, it's a really important question and one that we discussed at length. And there's a whole host of projects that probably are either very clearly bike lanes, things like that. And then there's projects that are increasing emissions, like doing a lane add. And then there's some that probably fall into a more of a gray area. What we've been tasked to do is start with the ones that are very clearly adding emissions and focus on the area that we know from our own analysis increases emissions. And so that's projects that add new lanes or create new interchanges where there wasn't one before.
So as part of that, are the MPOs having to determine like for themselves which projects are capacity adding or not? Jonathan, is that something you guys have gotten into?
So for the purposes of this work, there's a committee that was created by MnDOT that I and Stephanie both sit on that Chris coordinates, and that includes representatives from MPOs as well as DOT and from other experts that is helping to make these decisions about the edge cases. And so we certainly have an opinion, and in most cases, it's pretty clear what a major project is and isn't, and a project that falls under this requirement. But there is a more impartial committee that is collaboratively making that determination.
Great, thanks. And Stephanie, I want to bring you in too on this. So from your perspective as a both a smaller MPO and a bi-state MPO, how are you talking about project types and specifically which ones are adding capacity and need potential mitigation?
Well, I mean, there's a few kind of areas of being an MPO and representing on the committee. And we're all so different. I think that's a good thing to point out. They're all not equal. You look at the politics going on the local level and what the needs are wanting at the local level. So when you're looking at that as well as the bi-state, there's all these things that you have to juggle and look at when you're looking at projects, as well as what is being required of us as an agency. And then what is the needs and wants at the local level, and how can we get there and help the locals get to that answer? It'll be something that we'll have to navigate. I mean, we have plans out there already that go out to 2050. I mean, we have tips that are in the next couple of years. So it's looking at those projects, and even the next year or two, we'll be looking at 2055. So it's looking at those projects and how they align with these initiatives. And we're not the only MPO that's a bi-state too. So it's looking at those other MPOs that are bi-states as well. They have different communities all working together. So it's going to be a little bit of a juggle.
Yeah, I hear you that there's a lot of sort of factors that go into that. And certainly the different locations is part of it. So the other part of that, capacity adding projects, Chris, you talked about the legislation calls for figuring out ways to mitigate emissions from those projects. What does that mitigation piece look like?
What the legislature did was identify the categories that we have research on that shows certain investments reduce emissions and allow for folks to, you know, do mode shift and things like that. And so they identified transit investments, biking and walking investments, micromobility, travel demand management, and other kind of operational investments that we know reduce emissions. And when I say we know, what I mean is what the current research says happens if you build X, Y, and Z. It's very similar to folks are probably quite familiar with or in the safety space, where we have crash modification factors. And we take the best research that's out there around a safety improvement, and we say, what do we think happens if we apply that to this intersection or that roadway? And we're doing the same thing with emissions reduction and asking what types of investments do we know reduce emissions? And then those are the ones that are in the mitigation category.
Is it up to the MPOs then to determine, you know, we're going to do this capacity project, but then we're going to do this other thing to offset that as a mitigation?
Yes. And so, you know, I think a good analogy here, one that we've talked about quite a bit, centers on wetland mitigation. And, you know, typically what we're trying to do is avoid impacting wetlands. But sometimes, you know, when you build a school and that might be right where a wetland is. And so what we've set up as a society is that if you're going to remove that wetland, you need to go find and restore another wetland in a separate location. And very similar kind of concept is at work here, where what we're saying is, all right, we're trying to make investments that bring emissions down. Sometimes we might need to increase emissions and expand capacity for certain, you know, priority projects. But what we're now being asked to do is internalize the emissions impacts of that decision and mitigate for it.
That's a good analogy with the wetlands. I think a lot of folks get that. Stephanie, I wanted to see how you guys are thinking about mitigation. Have you gotten that far in terms of how this regulation is affecting your MPO and how to mitigate projects?
Ours personally, no. But when we look at projects, is there a sidewalk we can add in? Is there a bike lane? Are we thinking about transit? So there's always those where it hasn't been called that or had that name to it. I don't think we've always thought about it. It's always been in the back room of it. And my plan is to remind our local players around here is that we've already been doing this. This is just a different way to look at it and maybe give some of these things that we've already been doing a little bit more legs and help with these initiatives too. So,
yeah, that's a great point. Jonathan, are you guys getting into that conversation about mitigation?
We're really at the very beginning of it right now. But one of the things that applies in the Met Council area, because we're such a large MPO, is trading off where mitigation might happen. The legislative framework for this work prefers that mitigation occur in the community that the project is in, and then it sets this criteria of moving further and further away, being preferential towards areas of persistent poverty or historically disadvantaged communities, and then going out to the region and then going out statewide. Within the Twin Cities metro area, we have a rich bank of mitigation opportunities to draw from that smaller MPOs or non-metropolitan areas of the state, which are also covered by this legislation, might have more difficulty working with. But there's also going to be some necessity of trading off mitigation on a statewide basis as well. And I think we've only begun to scratch the surface of what that's going to look like.
So, Jonathan, I'm curious, and I'll put the same question to you, Stephanie, in a second, but I'm curious in terms of the Met Council, whether you've seen an impact on your day-to-day work, wherever you are in like your tip cycle or updating your MTP. Have you started to think about how is this going to affect project selection? Has it gotten that far?
The process just went into effect 6 days ago. So we haven't had the chance to really test it out yet. The trigger for the process is when a project enters the tip, and we haven't had a new tip amendment since then. But interim guidance has been put out that will describe what are the factors we need to look at, how we calculate what the needs for mitigation are. And that's going to be an important part of the process of adding projects to the TIP going forward. But what we're starting to do is, of course, the TIP is too late to be making those decisions. We need to develop in our transportation planning and programming processes places where we identify much earlier what the VMT and greenhouse gas impacts are going to be of an individual project, doing preliminary assessments of what the mitigation needs are going to be and putting those in place and identifying those well in advance of those projects entering the TIP. So we've just, again, we're just scratched the surface of that. This process just went into effect at the beginning of this month, but it's going to have pretty dramatic impacts on the way that we think about how projects are selected, what they ultimately cost, because these mitigation amounts are going to need to be built into the cost of the project in a fiscal sense, and how the mitigation is ultimately identified.
I think that's a great point about, you know, it's triggered when you go to put something in the TIP, but you need to think about the impacts of that project well before it's in the TIP, before, you know, as you're putting into the long-range plan. As you get further into implementing this, that'll become much more of a relevant factor.
And part of the thing that makes it a little bit easier is, although our process requires us to do an analysis, we know what the results are going to be from at least a directional perspective. It's not like a project enters the TIP and we do an analysis of a capacity expansion project and see whether it increases or decreases greenhouse gas emissions. We know it's going to almost always increase it. And so it's categorically, we can say for certain types of projects, early in the process, we need to start identifying mitigation of some sort. And the analysis will be about what the magnitude is.
Makes sense. So, Stephanie, again, we know it's early on in the implementation of this law, but how do you see it factoring into the work you're doing with your TIP or your long-range plan or other documents?
I just piggyback on what Jonathan said. I mean, we always want to make sure all our plans are complementing each other as well as backing up what our TIP is doing. and moving forward and going into the future. I mean, we have our 2050 out right now. So we have a list of short, long, medium range projects already identified. But then in the next couple of years, we're going to be updating that. So we do that every 5 years. So it'll be the 2055 plan. So that will be where we start asking those questions with our partners for when we're doing that planning process and making sure that they are thinking about that and having that lens on as well. And then reminding them, especially with the short-term ones, those are the near future ones. And those were what the ones are going to go into your TIP. So making sure we're all aligned with that and then that trickling up to the state level.
Circling back to the mitigation efforts again, Chris, you mentioned a whole host of things that could count, you know, investments in transit, investments in walkability, bikeability, TDM. Is there a role for looking at land use, looking at ways that changes in land use could potentially enhance accessibility, reduce the length of trips, reduce the number of trips, things like that? Stephanie, is that something you guys are looking at all, land use impacts on greenhouse gas emissions from transportation?
Not sure what meeting it was, but I made the joke that I'm just, what was it, the land use person? It was one of the things I was pushing hard on. I'm a firm believer on you're on that road for a reason. You're going from point A to point B, and it's because of a land use. You're leaving your house. You're going to either work or school or taking your kids or errands. So I think they go hand in hand. Not all MPOs, of course, do land use plans. Ours does for both cities. I think that was a very important thing to look at as we're looking at our transportation network is what is the land use that's feeding it to get from those points. So there's never really been push on our side of the world on that. I was even hoping just like even a mention, a component just talking about land use, because I'm going back to complementing plans. If you start putting a little bit of language in each of the plans that kind of back each other up. So it's not something that it's a standalone plan or study by itself or initiative, but you've read about somewhere. It helps each other out with the conversation. So that was just a big thing that I thought was important to have in there, just to even maybe open up the door of maybe potential funding in the future for MPOs to get to support them on land use initiatives and efforts to do that planning. So you're bridging those two worlds a little bit more. So I'm glad that it got a little bit more mention in the legislation than I initially thought. So,
well, I'm glad you've been pushing that. You've been the land use person. That's good to know. That puts you in an unusual position where if you're the MPO and you're also that heavily engaged in land use planning and the local governments are accepting of that and they're sort of grasping that land use transportation connection.
Yeah, we actually update the land use plan every 5 years like we do our transportation plan. So they adopt it as their own. There's staff and funding that goes along with it. So that's nice to have from an MPO side. So no, they're very supportive. They're very involved. And it usually it's part of our five-year cycle. So it's something we've been doing since the 80s.
That's a great example. So Jonathan, I'm going to put a similar question to you. How is this regulation changing, if at all, the way you're thinking about land use?
I'm not sure it's changed a lot yet. To some level, the council has a pretty well-developed set of land use policies that reflect the fact that the council has a somewhat unique set of land use authorities among MPOs. We have the review authority for local comprehensive plans for consistency with regional systems. And so that's both a lot of authority and also a significant piece of work that has resulted in continuing land use planning and in coordination with cities and townships for decades. And so that being said, the legislation that created this process also creates specific comprehensive plan requirements for local communities around greenhouse gas mitigation as well that we will ultimately have to coordinate with. And then there is the piece of how it fits into the overall process as well, because some of this becomes an effort in accounting. And we are developing on a project level methods to identify specific mitigation targets in terms of tons of greenhouse gases that need to be reduced. And there's work that has to be done both probably at the council level as well as part of the statewide process of identifying what the specific impacts of land use policy changes can be, so that we can account for them in the same way that we can account for more discrete projects. We know that the impacts of land use are gigantic, but we don't necessarily have the same fine-grained calculation tools that we do for other projects.
For sure. And that's got to be pretty complex in a region as big as the Twin Cities and with that many municipalities and counties. And I heard you say, Jonathan, that you guys have a role in reviewing the comp plans for all of your local. Okay. So that's a whole job in and of itself.
We have a whole group for whom that's their primary job that is working with local communities and providing technical assistance on their local planning.
Yeah. It sounds like similar to Stephanie, you're very involved in land use planning, which is good. Chris, do you want to weigh in on this?
You know, I think that Stephanie and Jonathan have really summarized the land use dimension of this quite effectively. The one thing I would add is that when the folks were putting this together, one of the things that they did want to ensure is that it was encouraging growth and development patterns that would allow for good multimodal transportation to take root. And the shorthand on this really has been that we often get at the DOT level, we're often getting requests for expansion related to a community in an area growing. And saying, my area is growing, and we need to expand the transportation system. And yet, we often have capped what can be done for land use in a given area. This is just sort of a common practice in America. And so we almost don't even think about it anymore. But what now we're being asked to do is say, all right, if you are seeing the transportation system needing to grow, we should also, from an efficiency standpoint, from a cost effectiveness standpoint, be allowing for development patterns to be consistent with that investment so that it is being done in a prudent way.
That can get very sticky with telling the local governments, like, you need to be open to upzoning, potentially open to mixed use.
Well, and that's a really important point. The DOT, we do not have, you know, land use authority. What the legislature did, though, is said for these types of projects to move forward, if communities are making land use changes, we should be giving them credit for that. Because we do know that when we are developing in a more connected way, that it reduces the emissions rates in an area. And they wanted to make sure that was a component of this and that growth would be encouraged to take place, but making sure that's happening, you know, in an efficient and effective way.
And like a little bit of an incentive within the legislation to rethink some land use changes.
Exactly. 100%.
So it seems like this legislation would also call for potentially a change in the way an agency is modeling travel demand and having to think about, is there a potential to induce demand from certain projects? I mean, that seems to be the basis for the whole assumption that expanding capacity is going to expand emissions. How has it, if at all, changed the way you guys are thinking about travel demand modeling? Jonathan, do you want to start with that one?
It's created an opportunity for the issue of induced demand to come to the forefront and really has created a discussion venue around where travel models are capturing or not capturing key pieces of induced demand, because getting the amount of VMT that is being produced, getting the amount of greenhouse gases that are being produced, that number, that's it. That's what we're trying to calculate. So understanding induced demand is critical. We know that travel demand models are imperfect in that regard, that they capture some elements of induced demand. They don't capture other elements of induced demand. And then the question really becomes, well, what do you do about that? You can't just wave your hands and make all of our models much better instantly. And so what do we do in the interim when we have to make this process work? And that both has required us to really look into how our models are behaving around induced demand. And I'm speaking specifically of the model that we run in the Twin Cities, which is a state of the practice activity-based model. In smaller MPOs and statewide, it's a different situation. But also, it's important to look at other methods for calculating VMT, more simple and elasticity-based calculation methods. And we've been considering both of those and having robust discussions about what that should look like. Also recognizing that those elasticity methods in many cases are models that were designed by academia or designed with data that is not current or are designed to do slightly different things than we're trying to do. It's really the work of forecasting all the time, which is trying to make use of all of the tools that you have at your disposal and the best methods that you have practically available to make the best decisions that you can right now.
Yeah. And you guys are in a slightly unusual position in that you're using an activity-based model. You guys are using Activity Sim, right?
We're moving towards Activity Sim for our production model and are hoping to be there in a couple of months. We're using as an earlier model formulation right now, but we're in the process of moving towards Activity Sim.
Gotcha. Just wanted to get a plug in there for Activity Sim. That's a program that we help administer.
Definitely appreciate that.
Stephanie, I imagine you guys are in a fairly different position in terms of modeling. How has this, if any way, changed your travel demand modeling or your role in it?
Well, with any kind of change, you look at it a little bit differently and a self-reflection of how does this affect us. But with me, I mean, I represent, of course, my own MPO, but then as the other MPOs in the state too. And we're all differently. Some have more access to other more resources than others. Some do more modeling than others and the different softwares. So it's going to be a case by case, depending on the MPO and their situation. And I mean, with ours, we're by state. So we're not only looking on the Minnesota side, but the North Dakota side and how that feeds the model and what that looks like. And everyone's going to be different. So I don't have one answer for that, but it's going to be, everyone's going to be doing that self-reflection and what that looks like for them.
Yeah, you're hearing from a bunch of the MPOs, it sounds like, the smaller ones.
Yeah, we're just one of eight in the state, so.
Right. So Chris, is this something you're talking with other MPOs about too, in terms of modeling or the modeling that you guys do at the state level for MnDOT?
Well, I think this legislation overall has us looking quite a bit at how we analyze projects, how we model outcomes, and has asked us to reflect on the key decision points that move projects forward and what are the underlying assumptions that are being used to make those investments, especially the types of investments that we're talking about here. As we mentioned, the projects that add capacity in the state of Minnesota are a handful of projects any given year. We're not doing a lot of capacity expansion, but they're some of the most high-cost projects that are happening. One of the key outcomes from our research and analysis and the tax effort, this transportation advisory committee that we keep mentioning, has been to look at these core questions of the types of tools that we're using and ensure that the method for estimating these impacts is using the current research on what happens when you expand on the transportation system. And what we have found is that when you expand the transportation system, you do create a proportional response in terms of induced travel, as you were asking about earlier. And that is something that we are being asked to be more accountable to in this process. And we'll be continuing to talk more about that. I think at the federal level, I would just make a closing comment about some of the IIJA bill that passed a couple of years ago outlined a requirement for greater standardization on how travel demand models are used and to study that effort or to study how these key tools are being used for decision-making on projects, because there's often these models and then there's how these models are being applied. And that's a key question. And one of the things that we have found is probably need for greater standardization on that. That's more of a comment across the country on how we apply these models and what are the underlying assumptions being used. And that's been a topic of discussion quite some time and continue.
That's a whole can of worms there. How the models are run, how they're used, how people understand them. I think we've got a webinar coming up on that later this year. So I'll ask folks to keep an eye out for that. So I've got one last question for each of you. We'll go round robin one more time. Just wanted to get sort of a big picture take of, do you think the legislation overall will change the mix of projects? Chris, you mentioned there weren't that many capacity adding projects in the state, although they do tend to be big ticket items. Do you think there'll be fewer of them coming down the pike? How do you think it'll affect the mix? And we'll start with you, Chris.
Legislation that folks created was modeled after some work that's been happening in a couple of other states, most notably Colorado. And they are a couple years ahead of us even in terms of implementation. And we actually had a meeting with them a couple of months ago. And one of the things that they commented is that when their requirements to be more accountable for emissions impacts in the transportation sector came into effect, it didn't immediately change kind of processes and decision-making and how folks were thinking about projects. But over time and over the last couple of years, it has shifted how folks think about benefits and costs related to projects. And it is shifting the types of projects that are being prioritized. I think the core question that we are getting in the transportation space, at least, is we noted that emissions in the transportation sector are the highest of any sector. And so folks are saying, all right, are the investments that you are making in the transportation system on that bringing emissions down? And that's a pretty intuitive question to ask and a difficult one to answer because of some of the things that we talked about a few minutes ago related to travel behavior and travel patterns. However, we have been tasked with starting with an area that we know has an impact and to mitigate in a very direct way and to start with a type of investment that we know has an emissions impact and that we can measure it.
I think that's really interesting to know that you guys have, you know, sort of looked at Colorado as a state that was a little bit ahead of the curve. It's interesting to see what impact it's having there. And obviously in Minnesota down the road. Stephanie, what's your take on this as a smaller MPO? And you've been talking to other, you know, the smaller MPOs in the state. Do you see it affecting the mix of projects in the future?
I think it will. I think with any kind of change, there's going to be a shift. How big of a shift, I'm not really sure. But I mean, the role we're definitely going to play is, I'm sure that other MPOs will, is just helping with that partnership and that strong partnership with the local agencies and helping them navigate this new change and what's required of them and looking at it in a positive light. That we're, with anything, the change is hoping to make things better. So let's work together and make sure we're all aligned with what we, our vision for our community looks like and to the future.
And Jonathan, we'll end with you. What's your best guess for how this will affect, if at all, the mix of transportation projects in the Twin Cities region?
The wrinkle I would add is it's hard to say because it's also not happening in isolation as a policy. At the same time as this is happening, climate mitigation and greenhouse gas emissions have become a much bigger part of our regional goals and objectives that are going into our transportation policy plan that we're going to be adopting later this month. That's going to make its way into scoring criteria and selection criteria as part of our regional solicitation for federal funds. So a lot of these questions and a lot of these changes would be happening with or without this legislation. So it's hard to isolate the impact of this legislation, but it's going to have an impact. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what the push and pull factors are going to be, both on the decision-making process that people are making, as well as potential tweaks that might be made to legislation if we see unintended consequences as a result.
I think that's an excellent summary. We'll have to see and we'll have to check in a year, 2 years, however far down the road, and see how this affects the work all of you are doing in Minnesota. So I really appreciate all of you joining us. Chris Barron with MnDOT, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And Jonathan at Met Council, appreciate you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great discussion.
And finally, Stephanie in Grand Forks, we appreciate you being part of the podcast.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll have more episodes coming soon on Amped Up. So please, as they say, rate, review, and subscribe, and we'll talk to you again soon. Take care.